Session number 8744.
Mr. Grinham, reel 3. So, after you'd made friendly contact with this headman, what did you then do as far as setting about your work was concerned?
Well, first of all, we'd lost some kit on the drop. It was a bit of a tangle between ourselves and the RAF. But it was eventually sorted out. But we didn't know at that stage whether we could trust the headman or not. So we had to find our way into the jungle, get our kit together, get into some reasonably safe place until we got to know the lie of the land. And that took a few days, but once we got our kit together and got some charging equipment, which we'd lost on the original drop, we got ourselves established.
And what did your work consist of?
My work was, of course, mainly radio operating, looking after the radio. We had a different type of radio altogether here from the one in France. It was a much more powerful one, but it was not self-contained. We had to have batteries and charging equipment to charge the batteries. Without them, we were lost. So my main thing was keeping the batteries charged and, of course, ciphering and just looking after ourselves. We were just fully engaged in doing that.
How did you keep the batteries charged?
We had a portable hand generator and also a portable steam generator. The steam generator, although it was portable, weighed 90 pounds, but it worked with a boiler and a brazier, and you used to keep it stoked up, and the little generator would charge your batteries.
Did you receive and transmit in the same way as you had done in France?
Much the same, yes.
With the two.
Communication was quicker because we didn't have to bother with the hand generator.
Why not?
Well, the hand generator in France worked the tra directly worked the transmitter, and this one it was a different kind of charger, and it just merely charged the batteries. So you didn't actually have to do any winding while you were operating. You got your set was directly operated by your batteries. You charge them in between.
How many periods a day did you transmit?
It was the same as in France, half an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon, and vice versa the next day.
Was it just as easy to transmit and receive there?
Not quite. We did have some atmospheric troubles, but not very, very much. In general, communication was very, very good.
What type of atmospheric troubles?
Well, static rattles. It was some in the evening you'd have very great difficulty because of the electrical disturbances in the air.
And what type of material were you transmitting?
General intelligence on jet positions and targets.
Who was gathering the intelligence?
Well, we had a nucleus of scouts who used to go out and get the information, which we had to, again, had to verify because the locals were very, very much exaggerative, if you like, in numbers and so on. So we had to be very, very careful in assessing the numbers of Jap soldiers. It was verified, and we used to get the information out. The officers would do that.
How did you get the scouts?
It all originated from the headman we met, partly from his family, and we went from family to family and branches of the family. And they all then came to help us. And they were very, very good. There was no traitor amongst them. We could thoroughly and absolutely rely on them. We had no troubles whatever in that way.
Did you pay the scouts?
Yes, they were paid in. We had to pay them in Jap-forged currency. They would not accept British money because if they were caught with it, the Japs would know they'd been in touch with British soldiers. So we had to pay them in Jap forged currency.
Were they happy to accept that?
Yes.
How much were they paid?
I can't remember.
Were they happy with
it? I had nothing at all to do with the payment of them. But they were quite happy with what we gave them.
How would they go about collecting the intelligence?
Well, they used to go out into the local villages. They'd known for a long time where the Japs were, and they did in fact give us some very, very good intelligence from time to time, although they didn't appreciate exactly what they were giving us in one particular instance, at a place called... Switch off a moment. They saw at a place called An. In the river there, at low tide, they would see some rather large, or what they call cylindrical objects. We made further inquiries and found that it was petrol which the Japs were keeping under covers and dispersed. So they also were saying that in a banyan tree they'd hollowed it out and they'd stacked a lot of boxes. So we gave this information. We knew what it was petrol in the drums, and it was boxes of ammunition in this banyan tree. So we gave that to the RAF, and they suitably dealt with it within a matter of a couple of days.
Did they set it alight?
Yes, they blew it up.
Did you see it?
No, it was too far away. We could hear it. Used to hear quite a lot of activity by the RAF, but we didn't see it. We were in thick bamboo jungle.
How long were you there?
3 months.
What were your main problems personally there?
Main thing was keeping under cover, keeping our supplies going, and keeping the radio going. No special personal problems apart from just looking after oneself.
Did you fall sick?
No. A little bit of dysentery, but we kept that under control.
No malaria?
No, we're taking our Mepocrine religiously. We had to. One thing you could not do was to fall sick.
What would have happened if you had?
Well, we would have been without wireless communication for one thing, and we would have been able to move. You would have been, your movements would have been very, very much restricted.
Did you have any close shaves with the Japanese?
No special ones, no. We knew their movements and when they were after us, and we never used to stay in one place more than a few days. Our locals went out, told us where the Japs were, which tracks they were using. They'd been well used to it for years. So we were on pretty safe ground.
Did you move from one village to another?
We kept away from villages. We went through the jungle, sometimes had to hack our way through it, so we would avoid tracks, and we never went into villages at all.
Why not?
Well, where the less people who knew who we were, which way we were going, the better. In most of the villages, there might have been informers, so we just kept away, kept off the beaten track. And let other people go in. The locals who were used to it, they used to go into the villages. They were known.
Did you have any problem with wild animals?
No.
Were there any dangerous animals in the area?
There were elephants because we followed elephant trails. And we've seen very recent footprints of members of the cat family, but we never actually saw much in the way of animals apart from monkeys.
Did they cause you any problems?
No.
Did you stay roughly in the same area the whole 3 months?
In roughly the same area, within a radius of probably 10 miles or something like that.
Did you know that the Japanese were looking for you?
Yes. The locals told us that. They knew we'd dropped, but they didn't know where we were. So we kept one jump ahead of them.
What type of information would you receive from India?
It was mostly requests for information. And, of course, how far the British advance had got. But not very much in that way of information coming in. It was requests for information.
How did your 3 months with Force 136 come to an end?
Well, we were eventually overrun by the 81st and 82nd Brigade of the Nigerian troops. So we made our way to them. It was a bit hairy, we going through the Jap positions, but we made it all right. We got shot up by the Nigerians, but we got away with it. We stayed with them for a while until transport could be arranged back to Calcutta, and we flew back into Calcutta. We went back to our base in Horana, and I stayed with them there until the war ended.
How did you come to be shot at by the Nigerians?
Well, we were making our way through, and they could see this body of men coming up. They didn't know. At least the frontline troops didn't know. The intelligence officer knew that we were there, but they didn't know where we would come in. So we had to go in with a white flag. But first of all, they let fire with their guns, but they missed us.
It was just a narrow miss?
I could hear the bullets whizzing past.
What impression did the Nigerian troops make on you?
Well, we were greeted by them. They were massive specimens of humanity. They didn't know whether they could trust us or not. They were perhaps a little bit unfriendly, I won't say hostile, until they realised who we were, because we were, our uniforms by then were really worn and torn and falling to pieces. So we didn't look like very smart soldiers. But we were greeted by the brigadier, and went to the various places for food, and that's where normal military discipline took over. The officers went one way, the NCO went the other. And now, because I stayed with the NCOs then, until we came out of Burma and back to Calcutta.
Did you think that was a pity to be split up?
Well, it's one thing that you expect in the army. You don't hobnob with officers in a normal army unit. There's always that distinction between you.
Can you describe how you got through the Japanese lines?
We had to go through very, very carefully, because we had to avoid any places where the Japs might be, and we also had to be very, very quiet, because we knew that the West Africans had audio phones, so they could pick up sounds where there might be movements of troops or movements of people through the jungle. So we had to be very, very quiet. So we came through there very quietly and made our way. And as we came to the West Africans, we used this white flag, but they let fly at us, but they missed us.
And then were you released from SOE after this?
Well, we were ready to go on other operations. Although I went ill, I went down to a dysentery, I went into hospital, and while I was in hospital, they dropped the atom bombs, and of course that was the end of the war. And shortly after that, Force 136 split up, and I went back to the Royal Armoured Corps at Pune. In both my missions to France and into Burma, the success of it was largely due to first-class leadership. And I can only say thank you to those officers for the way they led us and making certain that we did come through. There was a wonderful esprit de corps amongst us, and that still exists to this day. I'm still friends with them, and I hope I will always be.
Did the teams in France have a special name?
We were called Jedburghs, and we kept that name right from the very start of period with SOE. But when we went to Ceylon, we were just Force 136. We didn't hold the name of Jedburghs, but those who had been Jedburghs in France, we still kept that name to ourselves.
Do you know where what the origin of the name Jedburgh was?
I've no idea. It certainly hadn't any connection with the town of the same name.